Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Mary Wilson of the Supremes is our guest, and this interview came together quite quickly. She had a gig in Staten Island on a Saturday, and I think I heard on Thursday or Wednesday night, maybe, are you interested in interviewing Mary Wilson? I said yes, and then they got back to me. So I had less than a day to prepare for this. Usually I would try to read a guest's book. In this case, she's written many books, or do a bunch of research, but I threw it together pretty quickly. It turned out she was a person who, at least I'm guessing, I'm putting this together from the clues I received during the interview, a lady who's been interviewed a million times and didn't really want to, she kind of wanted to keep, she wanted to drive the train and not let me drive the train, but I tried to keep it on the tracks and tried to move it in my direction. I think you can hear a little bit of that push and pull in this interview. It's very edited. I took out a lot of things that didn't, where no one was driving the train, which might have been interesting, but not professional to hear. So I think it's interesting. I mean, the story of Motown's so important. And as I was putting together the notes for this, I was listening to the Supremes recordings and 12 number one hits. When you listen to them back to back, as I did, wow, it really is almost like a genre to itself, that sort of amazing Motown groove, those great songs, the production, the vocal performances, just the way it sounds, just the way that recording studio sounded and the way those guys played. It's really something so unique, and you can see why it just drove people crazy. Just great music. So one of, you know, the most important bands on one of the most important American labels ever. So I was happy to get a little insight into that, and I would sort of love to have her back, maybe under different circumstances. Anyway, Mary Wilson, super interesting. Hope you enjoyed this, and I will talk to you soon. Have a great summer, etc. Okay, folks, there is the Supremes, and tonight at the St. George Theater in Staten Island, Mary Wilson will be doing a show with Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. Big news, there's information on marywilson.com, but we've got the human being right here. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning to you, Michael.
You are the longest-serving member of the Supremes. You are an author, an advocate, a performer, and I was, you know, kind of doing some reading and some listening, and it seems like this is about the 60th year you've been singing. Is that about right?
I think so, because we started singing in 1959, and I wasn't very good at math. I was great in all my music classes and my English class. I was really cool in too. In fact, that's the reason why I have written three books. And the reason why I bring that up is that it was my English teacher in high school that suggested I become a writer. So what I did was I wrote this really wonderful paper, I guess you call it a thesis or something like that, and passed it in. He gave me an A++++, and he said, Miss Wilson, I think that you should consider becoming a writer because you write so well. And that's when I started keeping my diaries, and now I have four books because of my English teacher. So anyway, I saw him years later, and he says, Miss Wilson, I'm so happy that you didn't take my advice.
Well, in a way you did, right? Because you've got your books and your career. So that's great.
Yeah.
So you grew up, you mentioned you grew up in Detroit, and grew up in the very well-known Brewster Douglas public housing projects, which were sort of later blown up to some people's happiness. So those sort of had a darker reputation as time went on. But when you were living there, when you were growing up, excuse me, was it, what were your memories? Was it a place of a community, or was it this kind of dark place?
Oh, are you kidding? Let me tell you. Detroit was one of those places that was just fabulous. I mean, we had great communities. Of course, everything was segregated. You know, you had your Polish people in one area, you had your black people in another area, you had your white in another area, and it was all segregated. But still, people were really happy together. You know what I mean? It was really great. We had great, the school system, the educational system there was fabulous. We had great, great schools there. And it was fun. I mean, when I moved into the projects, it was a whole new development that we went to. And it was like having a new apartment building, you know what I mean? So the projects have gotten a very bad reputation or name, but basically we had a great upbringing in Detroit. I mean, I went to Aretha Franklin's father's church. So I used to see Aretha Franklin sing very early on in life before she became famous. So, you know, Detroit was a great city, and I got to tell people is that Detroit is coming back, okay? It may not ever be as great as it used to be, but it's coming back, and I'm so thrilled about that.
I know that you knew Florence Ballard from elementary school. You guys sang in talent shows. There was a group called The Primes, a bunch of guys, and in 1959, they wanted to make sort of a female counterpoint, the Primettes, and that's when the earliest version of the Supremes sort of came along with Diana Ross and Betty McGlown, and you guys started making records pretty early. I guess, am I right, the first Primettes record is Pretty Baby 1960, which would make you 16 years old, is that right?
We were about 15 because we signed our first contract with Motown in 1961, I think it was January. So when we were 15, we actually started recording before Motown. And there were four of us. There were four girls. We were a quartet. We were called the Primettes. And as you mentioned, the other guys were the Primes. But two of those guys went on to become the Temptations, and that's Eddie Kendricks and Paul Williams. So they were the Primes, and they joined Otis Williams and became the Temptations. So, yeah, we started, you know, recording very early on, but then we realized that, you know, we wanted to be at Motown. So we left this Lupine Records. So we went to Motown, auditioned for Mr. Gordy. He turned us down because at the time we were just barely 15 and a half or so. But instead of going away, we stayed there. When I say stayed there, every day after school, we would go and sit on the lawn and wait and wave at all the stars going in. And pretty soon they said, you know what, these girls look like they really want to be here, so they signed us up. And there you go. That's the history.
If you listen to those, you know, the Primettes recording and the early, like the very first Supremes, Tears of Sorrow, it definitely sounds, it definitely has a foot in the 1950s more than in the 1960s. But in the next few years, that the Supreme sound really evolves pretty quickly. And do you, you know, of course, the Supremes ended up having 12 number one hits, 33 top 40 hits. Do you remember actually seeing it, feeling the sound evolve?
Basically, we came from the doo-wop area. And, you know, that did have, you know, people like the Flamingos and the Platters, and I mean, all kind of people who were recording. That's who we were, you know, not copying, but that's who inspired us. You know, of course, you had the Shirelles, you had the Chantels, you had all those people. And so our sound early on was more of that early 50s sound because that's, you know, who we were listening to. However, when we went to Motown, then, of course, the Motown sound was also evolving. And when Mr. Berry Gordy put us with his top writing team, Holland, Dozier, Holland, which was Eddie and Brian Holland and Lamont Dozier, that's when our sound really changed because they had a different style of writing and producing. And that's how we got our first, 10 number one records, which was a rarity because, you know, that's when the British guys were coming over here. And not just guys, because you got people like Dusty Springfield who were coming over here, Dave Clark Five, the Rolling Stones. In fact, I don't know, we were on a show with the Rolling Stones in 1964 called, it was by Dick Clark Productions, and it was called Tammy, the Tammy Show. And that's when we first met the Rolling Stones, who were not really famous at the time. And there was this big dispute over who was going to close the show, James Brown or the Rolling Stones. Well, at the time, James Brown was the king, and the Rolling Stones were not as well known. And we all were talking about, well, who's going to close the show? You know, how in the world can this new group, the Rolling Stones, close after James Brown? And sure enough, you know, James Brown had to, you know, go on before Rolling Stones, and he was not happy about it. So, you know, there's a bit where he throws his cape off and then comes back. Well, he did that like 20 times so that the Rolling Stones would not be able to come on. But eventually, you know, he had to get off there, and the Rolling Stones came on, and they just blew the crowd away. Mm-hmm. So, Bill Wyman, who I work with Bill a lot of the Rolling Stones, he was the original bass player there, and he often talks about, you know, how they were scared to death, too, to come on after James Brown. So those were the good days. But, you know, like I said, we work with a lot of those British stars and Dusty Springfield and all, and yes, our sound became the sound, and we were giving the British groups a run for their money. You know, the Beatles would have number one, we'd have number two, then we'd have number one, they'd have number two.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things where we were one of the girl groups that really gave them a run for their money.
So when you arrive at Motown, Motown is sort of famous for this Motown system, sort of like it was like a factory approach, sort of very Detroit, right? A factory approach to producing this music. You had teams of writers and teams of producers and teams of musicians and folks with the costumes and with stage and with, you know, deportment and sort of charm school classes. Was it really like that? Or was it just that simple?
No. It wasn't like that. And people say that, but that's okay because I think every time anyone, if it's a singer, whoever it is, you always draw on what became what you grew up with, what you know. So, yeah, the factory system was very strong in Detroit, Michigan, because most of our parents all and everyone there worked in the factories. Berry Gordy had worked in the factory himself. So, yeah, that's where people get that from. However, the black community was one such that was so great. Berry's family was a black family that were very prominent in Detroit, Michigan. They owned stores and this and that. So everything was kind of patterned after our families and, you know, the certain things. At Motown, Berry's family all were working there. So, you know, a lot of that family situation came from that part of being a part of the family unit, and we all were accustomed to that growing up in black families, I should say. So, you know, we all kind of had that. They had the this school system, we called it the artist development, where we were learning how to you know, dress properly, stand properly, and all those kind of things. So we learned that from, you know, people around us, and Berry Gordy and Motown had the sense to know, you know, just like the Hollywood film studios, they taught all of the stars how to become beautiful people. So Motown had that same kind of system, but it was all drawn upon what we all knew and what they knew. So we were very, you know, fortunate to have that type of a system around us. But no one made anyone do anything is what I guess I'm trying to say. It was just one of those things where we wanted to be glamorous and we wanted to be better. So we had a good school system, as I said, even in Detroit, Michigan, in our schools. Because, you know, now they're taking the arts out of schools, and that's a part of what we learned, too, was in school we had shop, we had home economics, we had driver's ed. So we were taught a lot of things from the system, and all that was brought into Motown. And so I'm very pleased about that. And my book, my new book that's coming out, Supreme Glamour, talks about all of that. It talks about how, you know, we knew glamour and we wanted to be glamorous, and we were very fortunate that Motown had that same philosophy. Mm.
Let's talk about the very first number one hit, Where Did Our Love Go? It's a huge, I mean, it's like the biggest, catchiest track in the world. No way that was not going to be number one. So just let's use this as an example of how you guys made the records. I assume that you sang to a track, not live with the band?
In the very beginning, we were so fortunate to actually work and record with the band. Mm. And the band was called the Funk Brothers. They've since become extremely famous. There was a movie called Standing in the Shadows of Motown, and so they're talking about the band members. So we actually recorded with the band there in Studio A And lots of people are now visiting Motown Records, and they've seen the Studio A, which is very small. But back in those days, we didn't know it was, you know, how small it was. But yeah, we were very fortunate to actually record with the band. Where Did I Love Go was one of those songs. Now, let me tell you something about Where Did I Love Go. We did not like that song at all. And it was you mentioned, you know, it was a known fact that it was a number one. Not at the time. We hated the song. And so I recall Eddie Holland saying to us, just trust us, it's going to be a hit. And we were like, no, but we want to have a hit record. This doesn't sound like a hit record. But it did become our first number one record. And now, of course, I have to eat my words that we didn't like it, but we really didn't.
Okay,
but the world did.
So you guys are singing with the band. So how long did it take to get that track? Is it a day? Is it a few hours?
Well, it's not just that track, because we recorded we always recorded a number of songs within a day.
Right, but that particular song.
That was one of the easier songs we ever recorded. Some of them would take 25, 35 tracks. Now, we're talking about the Funk Brothers and the bass player who was Benny Benjamin. Well, we would often watch him. He smoked a cigar. And the whole band and the singers would watch this guy smoke the cigar while he's playing the instrument. So we would have to break and stop the track. If we're doing very well, we would have to stop the recording because his ash would fall off and everybody in the studio would die laughing. So that was one of the things that was so great about recording with the band, live band, because it was always something special that would happen, and we could either go straight through it or we can just burst out and start laughing. And that's what made the track so beautiful, because you had that spontaneity inside the studio. So that's why I wanted to say that, because oftentimes people don't really know what makes Motown sound so great. It's just being there with all the people.
So when these guys would bring a song in, would they play it on a piano? Would they run it? How would you first hear the songs?
Well, it really did that as well. There was not like one system. There definitely were a lot of different ways that everyone was approaching recording. Many times the guys, I'm speaking about Eddie, Brian, and Lamont, would bring a song to us on a track later, you know, later, not in the very early days. In the early days, most of the times they would play things on the, they would actually play things on, sorry. Most of the time, people would they would actually play them on the piano. But as time evolved, and they would actually sing the parts, too, because Lamont would sing the background parts. Eddie Holland would sing the lead, which was eventually, you know, Diane's part. And then Brian would normally play the piano, or he and Lamont would play the piano. So that would be one way that they would do it. However, later on, let's say when we became very famous and we traveled, we'd have to fly in for a day. And by then they had really started, you know, recording things before we would arrive. And so we would hear it on the track. So it really depended on, you know, how they approached things at the time.
1964, you mentioned the British invasion is going crazy, and a lot of American artists kind of lost their career. They just never figured it out. But that was, for you guys, you know, Where Did Our Love Go, Baby Love, Come See About Me, Stop in the Name of Love, Back in My Arms Again, 5 number one hits in a row. So the things were blowing up. You're still, you know, a 20-year-old young lady. Was this, did you deal with it well? Did you go, you know, was it easy, or was it just the pressure? Was that tough?
Well, for we the Supremes, it was fairly wonderful, I would say, especially for myself, because we started traveling internationally. And just like here in the States, people love the British invasion, we called it. They took to us the same way, in especially in the UK. So we were kind of like, you know, I remember one newspaper said, 3 black negresses have just landed on the shores of Great Britain. We're like, where? So, you know, we were kind of taken over there the same as the British invasion was taken here. And I absolutely adored it, because I had learned a lot in world history in school about world history, you know, American history and all that stuff. I loved studying. So For me, it was great to go to all these different countries, especially when we went to Sweden. We hung out with the princess of Sweden, and her brother eventually became the king. But they used to come to our show back in 1968. So, for me, this was very exciting, things I had read about in school and learned in school, and here I am now living that life. It was really, for me, great. Some people, it depends. If you enjoy traveling then was great. Maybe not so much now, but back then, Pan Am and TWA, American Airlines, it was really great flying. First class was definitely first class, and the seats were still bigger back then.
Yeah.
The one bad thing is that people don't know this, but they had smoking on the airlines back then, and on a plane, the smoke area would be in the back. So that was kind of bad. But traveling was great. I loved it. I loved meeting the different people. Japan was one of my favorite places because, everyone wore their kimonos, men, women, and the Ginza, which was downtown area, was just beautiful with all the various colors. So I enjoyed touring and traveling because, the world was coming. The world was really opening up, between different countries and continents and all. It was really opening up. And I think our music, really helped the world open up the way it has, the borders nowadays have opened up where you can travel here, there, travel there. So it was really cool. Yes, I enjoyed it. and it was there was a lot of pressure. You mentioned pressure. There was pressure because, you fly in and you had to immediately get on, do interviews and this and that. It was an all-day thing. And some people, if they didn't enjoy traveling or didn't enjoy meeting people, and some people don't, they have great voices. They just don't really like the people, And so for those type of people, it could have been pretty difficult. But for me, I love meeting people. I love the whole bit. So it was fun. It was fun for me. Still is. After 60-some years. You mentioned that earlier when we started. 60-some years, yeah.
Yeah, let's remind folks that Mary Wilson is our guest, and tonight at the St. George Theater in Staten Island with Martha Reeves and the Vandella, and you can get some information over at marywilson.com. 1967, another string of hits. Excuse me. You Can't Hurry Love, You Keep Me Hanging On, Love Is Here, Now You're Gone, The Happening. It's interesting how the Supreme sound evolves a little bit. Were these guys listening to what was on the radio and sort of evolving with that, or was it just kind of a natural evolution, do you think?
Well, probably both. I think it was more sort of knowing what else is being created, musically, that inspired our writers. And so I mentioned Holland Dozier Holland because they produced for us. But, of course, we had Smokey Robinson. You had Steve... you had all these different writers there, Norman Whitfield, who wrote for the Temptations later on. You had many types of writers there. So they had a lot of competition between the...
There's the fire.
Yeah, right, there's the fire out there. They had a lot of competition between the writers and the producers, but I don't think there was much competition between the actual artists, the singers, because we just enjoyed singing, So I don't think we were competing as much as perhaps the writers and the producers did. And all of that, I'm sure, helped them all evolve musically. Now, you take Stevie Wonder, for instance, who I think he was one of the first ones who started that synthesizer kind of sound, and he really moved that forward. I think the musicians and people who really were creating the music were the ones who helped move the artists forward. We just sing songs, we're just singers. But the producers and writers and musicians are the ones that actually created, the foundation for us to sing on. Mm.
I read Berry Gordy's book a while back, and he sort of really goes out of his way to point out how fair he was about money and how he never, ripped anybody off. And he almost goes, overboard with that. And in my experience, people who do that are usually trying to hide something or, it's the opposite of the truth. But I really wasn't there. You were there. How did it work with, contracts and money? Were things, did you have a fair wage and did you get paid what you actually earned?
Well, I'm going to say this. I'm Pisces. I have two people. I'm two fish swimming in different directions. But first of all, you need to read my book. Then you'll get a whole other concept. However, Mr. Gordy is a wonderful man. I mean, and he said to me, Marvin Gaye had an unveiling, not Marvin Gaye, but they unveiled the Marvin Gaye postal stamp here in the U.S. just recently, and I hosted the whole show. So when I introduced Mr. Gordy, I said, my mentor, Mr. Barry Gordy, he says, I didn't know I was your mentor. I'm like, yeah, we wouldn't be here were it not for Barry Gordy's dream of Motown and the Motown sound. So I absolutely adore that whole thing. However, contractually, you know, there were things that as artists you look back on now and you say, well, I should have had a higher royalties. So it all depends on who you talk to, you know, and the time that we're talking about, because this still was very early on in, you know, with people getting contracts and being paid fairly and that type of thing. But if you look back and you say, well, you know, maybe we weren't as fairly, the money wasn't, you know, divvied up the way it could have been. But, you know, that's the way things are. So read my book and maybe you'll have another idea of what was going on. What do they say? 10 people can see an accident and you get 10 different people's viewpoints. It's the same kind of thing, but we still should have been paid more. Okay, next.
Let's talk about, this is right in the middle of the civil rights era. Was there a Motown company policy, like we should address this as artists, as a company, or we should stay away from this and just entertain people? Where was there an official policy?
Oh, there was never an official policy. I think it had a lot to do with people's individual thoughts. However, a lot of us were very young. So politics in those days, in the early 60s, was not as prominent in the communities as it is now. You know, everyone has a definite viewpoint. You're either Democrats or Republicans or da-da, you know what I mean? But back then, it wasn't as systematically noted that you had to be this or that. However, the one thing that was probably within the community, especially the black community, was that our parents would always tell us, whenever you walk out the door, because you're black, you have to always put your best foot forward. That was perhaps the most important thing that our parents taught us. And they also taught us to hold our head up high. But in terms of politics, everyone wasn't speaking out in terms of what they were thinking. The only thing was that blacks had to move forward. Education was the most important thing. And you know what? It still is today, and it's almost not as prominent as it was back then, and it should be.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. 1967, Barry Gordy changes the name of the band to Diana Ross and the Supremes. I know she was the lead singer. She got a lot of attention. I'm sure it's in your book, but tell us, how did you feel? How did that go over with you?
Well, the thing about that is, I think it not only happened to the Supremes, but it happened to a lot of different groups. You know, if you could look at the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, originally it was the Miracles. You can look at a lot of different groups that had the name changed. Obviously, it never is something that people are like, oh, okay, you know, fine. With our group, we had our own whatever. We were happy that Mr. Gordy and Motown chose the Supremes to be their number one. We were very happy about that. And that, you know, one of us had to be chosen. We were happy about that, too, as long as he chose us as a group to put their money behind us, per se. Perhaps over time, it came a point where, because we all were singers, we didn't start out as one lead singer and background singers, you know. So we never thought of ourselves as background singers. So, you know, it was kind of, in the beginning, it was fine. It became a time when, as an individual and as a singer, well, you didn't want to sing more. It's like, oh, I look like I'm not going to get that part then, you know. So you did have that kind of feeling. But because we were all friends in the beginning, you know, no one ever, ever, ever hated the other. It was always just about love. But as an individual, I guess, you know, eventually things like that start to eat away if you can't do everything that you want to do as an individual. So I did address that in my book as well.
Around this time, you know, the end of the 60s, Florence quits. She's like your oldest, old friends. Holland, Dozier Holland leave. And like, you look at the Supremes catalog, and there's records like you guys singing Funny Girl in 1968, you know, right after Holland, Dozier Holland leave. And you're on the, you know, there, I think was the idea that the Supremes would appeal to a huge group, and that's why you did, you know, those kind of records?
Well, we always did, though. See, that's what a lot of people don't know. Even as the Primettes, we started out singing four-part harmony, which meant we sang a lot of songs that were not rock and roll. They were not doo-wops. They were like the American Songbook. We sang a lot of standards as a group. We always did. So when we became famous, obviously we started singing the rock and roll and the Holland, Dozier Holland, the Motown sound, which people knew us for. But we also had this other side to us that where we did sing those type songs. So when we started doing TV shows, we started showing that we could do those songs. And that's when those albums and songs became known to the public that we could do. We did the not only the Funny Girl album, but we did a Country and Western album. We did a Rodgers and Hart album. We did a lot of those type things because that's basically who we were as a group before we became famous as a pop stars.
Tell me about, you know, you were on so many TV shows and, you know, Ed Sullivan, and you must have ended up working with some of those old-time stars that you as a kid had grown up seeing on TV or, you know, hearing on the radio. Tell me something about one of those experiences.
Well, see, a lot of people say that even about today's artists, they say, why don't you sing with, we're the older stars now that you were talking about, did we ever sing with older stars? So now for this generation, we're the older stars. They don't do that as much as we did when we were coming up. We sang with people, we were on Sammy Davis' show, we did Las Vegas, we sang with the Andrews Sisters, we did shows with Bob Hope, we did shows with Pearl Bailey, with Lena Horne. We worked with all of the great legendary stars that we had grown up listening to. Today, for some reason, they don't do that as much. And, you know, you see the young people, which I'm very proud that they've carried on this legacy and making more money than we ever made, but they kind of leave us out of the scenario, which when we were coming up, we were not left out with the older stars. And that's something I think that they need to change. But, you know, it is what it is. So, yeah, we work with some great people. I mean, one of the persons I really enjoyed working with was Sammy Davis Jr. I mean, he was absolutely wonderful. He was just a wonderful guy. Diane Carroll, we work with a lot as well.
Yeah, that sounds so exciting just to be part of that. Yeah, that huge Hollywood thing. I mean, it doesn't get bigger than that. The Supremes kind of eventually finally end in 1976. Why call an end to it at that point?
Well, first of all, Florence was no longer in the group in the late 60s. Diane left in 70. And then I had to bring in other girls. I mean, I didn't have to, but I did because I did not want to end there. And so I had some beautiful ladies, talented ladies, Jean Terrell, Sherry Payne, Linda Lawrence, and Suze Green, all at different times, of course, joined the group. And so I eventually said, you know, this changing of the arms, you know, the guards, is just not happening because we three were the ones who made the history. We three were the ones who, you know, were famous. So my continuing on bringing in new girls, Eric, because it just wasn't, you know, I think it was just time. It's time to quit, time to end it, because, you know, I didn't want to spoil our history, and it was beginning to feel like that. So I ended it in 1976 and started singing on my own, and it's taken me all these years. I'm 75 years old now. It's taken me all these years to finally learn how to sing again, which hopefully I've done. And people will see that tonight, of course. Right. And, you know, so sometimes you just have to know when to, you know, they say a fighter needs to know when to get out of the ring. And I knew it was time then, so that's why I disbanded the group at that point.
One of the things you've done since then is you've been a vocal advocate against what I would call fake bands, you know, bands who have mm-hmm. no original members or mm-hmm. or just completely, you know, made up versions of bands. How did that start?
Well, I'm one of the artists. There are many of us artists who have been out there on that trail trying to stop people from stealing our famous names. And they have started, you know, fake groups, as you call them, bogus group, as we call them, have come up and I'll just outright say it, you know, stolen our names. It's almost like they say, I forgot what they say. Anyway, people were stealing our histories and calling themselves the Supremes. They were calling themselves the Coasters and the Drifters, and they were so young. It's like, you couldn't possibly have made those records. How could you have made those records? You know, those are from the 50s. So anyway, a lot of us artists got together and decided, and we marched on Capitol Hill, and we decided that we had to get some laws passed to stop people from stealing our names. Identity theft. It's the same as identity theft. So we went to Congress, and we got them to pass the bill in about 35, 40 states, I think, today. And the bill is called Truth in Music. So unless you were there to record that music, you cannot be a group to go out and call yourself by that famous name. So that's something that's going on.
You started so young, and you've had, everybody knows the word Motown, and there is no mm-hmm. doubt that the Supremes were the most successful Motown act. Is it a little bit mind-blowing, or is it just, I had some good breaks and made the best of it, or how do you feel?
Well, probably different now than I did a long time ago, because there were many, many artists at Motown who were huge and probably personified more of the Motown sound than we did, like Stevie Wonder, you know, Smokey Robinson, Diana Ross. I mean, there were many people there who are, you know, major forces in the music industry. As a Supreme, I'm very happy that I finally have that feeling that, yeah, we contributed just huge amounts of everything to the music industry. So I'm happy. I now see how relevant we were or are to American history in terms of music. I'm very happy to have been a part of that and to have been a Supreme. So but long time ago, I was just happy to be up there on stage singing, you know.
You just didn't occur to you to think about your place in history or your part of the soundtrack?
No, I was so busy just enjoying and doing it. And, you know, sometimes that's important, because if you think too much about who you are, what you've done, it becomes more important than really enjoying the enjoyment of what you're doing. So I've always been the kind of person, I enjoyed what I was doing first.
Well, tonight folks can see you out at the St. George Theater with Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. Mm-hmm. What's your show like these days? I mean, I assume it's just a mm-hmm. celebration of mm-hmm. this wonderful music.
Mm-hmm. Well, my show today, I have several. Now I'm doing just the rock and roll show. In fact, Martha Reeves of the Vandellas also, she'll be doing her Dancing in the Streets, you know, and Heat Wave, and I'll be doing Reflections and all those kind of songs. So we're really celebrating Motown's 60th anniversary this year, doing a lot of rock and roll concerts. So it's more of a fun night. My jazz clubs, which I did last week, are more of just sit back and just enjoy the beautiful balance, you know, whatever. So there are different shows. Tonight is going to be fun.
Folks can get more information, of course, at your website, marywilson.com, and there's stuff about your books, and there's videos and all kinds of stuff to mm-hmm. read. And it's such an interesting story, and, you know, Motown is such a part of the culture in American history. Mm-hmm. It's always mm-hmm. interesting to hear about it. Mary Wilson, mm-hmm. thanks, sir, for visiting with us this morning.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you.
Been happening to us in the last 2 years. Okay?
Not all. Pulling me
closer to your heart. And who the Beatles like this number very much. We got letters and everything with telling us how much they really enjoyed Stop in the Name of Love.
Hi, this This is Florence of the Supreme Burgers. If you'd like to join the Scotty Regan Burger Club, send your name and address to Burger Club, WKNR, Box 1300, Detroit.
Now, this is where you come in. The Scotty Regan Sing Along with the Supremes Contest. Full details tonight, 8 o'clock, right here, WKNR.
Christine?
Yes?
This is Scotty.
Thank you.
Congratulations, dear.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Let's listen to you sing for a second, okay?
Okay.
How do you like yourself on the radio?
It's funny. I've never heard myself before like that, and it really sounds funny. You're not used to it, you know?
It sounds a lot different than that.
Yes, it does. Hey.
Hey, Mary. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very, very good.
That's good.
What's happening?
Well, we're having a mellow time out here in Vegas.
I bet you are. Is that your first time to Vegas?
Yeah.
How do you like it?
Well, the crowds have been beautiful, and we've had packed shows every night, so we have to like it.
Hey, that's great.
Here, let me let you speak to somebody else.
Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated? Good night.